To you, this is great because I come to a place where I don't have to do clusters 101. But I will say that the space that is understood by everybody in this room is beginning to be very, very much on the forefront of policymaking. And all of you who have been working at the state and the regional level know that great ideas have been bubbling up for years and years and years. But the federal government has been absent, and it's been living in these silos. And it's been living with an attitude that the government doesn't have a role. And I know as part of our paper, and you've heard about it today, we actually went and counted all of the federal programs. And they're in the Brookings, website. You can actually link to them. All the federal programs that do regional innovation, invest in regional inputs to clusters or other things, and there were 250 of them, $77 billion. And you all know that it's in labor, it's in commerce, it's at the SBA, it's really across, it's in energy. And then you add to that, because when we wrote that paper, we didn't even have at that point the Recovery Act. And Brookings did a terrific paper, which is also up on their website, where they listed every single program in the Recovery Act that is related, and I really highly recommend that to you. And Andy Riemer can point it to, you to it if you don't know. But it's a very, and you see how all of these endeavors, whether they're in energy, whether they're in commerce, whether our programs in the SBA, are designed to do the same broad thing, which is create jobs, drive innovation, and create jobs. So we know 70% of the jobs are created in small businesses. Small businesses, 50% of the population either owns a small business or is employed by a small business. We know that if we are going to be competitive going forward, large companies are going to have to compete globally. They're going to have to locate their assets in China, take care of the Chinese market. GE is going to go after appropriately all these things all over the world. Who's going to create the jobs, the good-paying jobs here in America? Well, we know it's going to be, they're going to be innovation-driven companies that grow to be our next foundations for competitiveness. And we have to think, where in the federal government is that initiative going to live? It's going to live in multiple places, but how are we going to create the umbrella structure that's going to make that a priority? And that priority, that initiative, is very much now in formation. This is the moment. And all of you are working hard in all kinds of places to make sure that this is understood. And the piece that's missing is not the understanding that this is going to be the underpinning, but kind of the structure underneath it. So what does this mean? And you know all of those pieces. So I want to ask for your input, challenge you to come back and help us articulate this structure that's going to be underneath this concept, that we are going to turn innovation into jobs, that that's going to be the underpinning of America's competitiveness. We're going to create good-paying jobs here in America as we see the GMs and the Chryslers suffer and transform. We have other initiatives. And when you're in Kokomo, Indiana, as I was last Thursday, and it's 25% Chrysler and Delphi employment, and you talk to Mayor Goodnight, and he says, help me do this. You know we have to do this. We have to succeed. And this is the moment where those towns, those people, those employees, those businesses need us to come up with this construct. So we are engaging with input. It is not going to be a perfect structure. It is not going to, you know, necessarily be elegant. But I think at the moment it is going to, we have the opportunity to do a number of things that are going to be functional, that are going to bring together all these existing efforts and programs in a pretty powerful way. So I'll stop there, and I'd like to take, if I still have a couple minutes, a couple questions, and we can talk about this further, and we'd also like your input going forward. The people who are leading this initiative we are leading this initiative with the White House through the NEC. Ginger Liu from the SBA is detailed to the NEC. Many of you know her. She's taking a lead in this. You heard from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, extremely involved. You heard Commerce is taking a leadership role in a number of these things. And the president is extremely interested in how this innovation, how innovation gets turned into jobs. So we need to figure it out, and I know we all can. Yes.
Hi, I'm Chris Gabriel from the Heinz Endowments in Pittsburgh. One of the things that we've noted is that when we have tried in Pittsburgh to work with the SBA, we have Carl Knobloch there, who's a really terrific person, with our tech transfer offices at the universities, we discover that the programs for that the SBA supports don't ever quite fit the small tech companies that are trying to grow, whether out of the universities or other companies. And so I just would ask, have you thought about how we can make these things work a little bit better together? Because you tend to have separate programs like the Ben Franklins and others to focus on tech companies, but in principle, it would be wonderful if you could get the banks to be able to think of a tech company as not higher risk than Wendy's franchise or something.
Yeah, so let me, this is a sort of a thought piece I guess I wrote for CAP, but never got published. But I want to talk a little bit about the two kinds of small business. And it's very important to understand the SBA that we've had a one-size-fits-all policy. You're a small business, you're small. But actually, there's at least two kinds of small business. We all know that there are lots of kinds. But in this sort of paper, which is out there somewhere in sort of final draft, we talk about the fact that there's Main Street small business and there's high growth, high impact small business. And they have different needs. And the SBA has many programs, as you've defined, which really all of our 7A and even our 504 deal a lot with the restaurant on Main Street. It's going to close. It's going to open. When it opens, it needs an SBA loan to do the new fixtures. All of that churn we support. And if we don't, we won't get the churn. We won't get those jobs. But the high growth, high impact, many of them do get 7A loans and 504, but they also rely on other programs we do. We do SBIR, which is up for reauthorization, and I hope that a lot of you will write some letters of support because the rubber's going to meet the road in the next 30 days on that. So particularly on the university side, we need people to understand that this is a partnership arrangement, not an one's fighting the other arrangement. But we have SBIR, we have SBICs, and we probably need, and we are talking to a lot of you folks, about additional equity capital programs, sort of the next generation SBICs, because that was kind of a 90s construct when you didn't have a lot of the other tools. So this is very much on our minds as one of the only areas, I think, where we have to really change our programs. But this thought process of Main Street small business and high growth, high impact. And we have to make the point that high growth, high impact companies, they are in every, this is the Zolt Knox thing, they are in every county, in every state. Their average age is 24 years. I said, oh, the entrepreneur is 24 years. They said, no, the company is 24 years. And they're laughing because these are 100-year-old companies. I was at one yesterday, 100-year-old company, fourth generation, transforming itself outside of Columbus to be viable today. So these are in every place. They're in manufacturing. They're not just white lab coats. They're not just on the two coasts. And they're not all sort of startups. And we need to be there for them, as you point out, as well as we're there for Main Street.
Hi, Jane Muir, University of Florida, Office of Technology Licensing. We start about 10 companies a year based on our university technology, and I'm delighted to hear that you're thinking about programs to support that. We heard a little bit about the Valley of Death, and being a venture capitalist, you can certainly appreciate that. Talked a little bit about fund to funds, different things like that. Are you currently exploring any programs like that that might be of assistance?
Yes, we are, and we've put a placeholder pilot in our budget, which you can take a look at, to go exactly in those directions because it is a funding need, and we're talking about doing it with all kinds of things, including guarantees. But very much at the initial stages, we've got a bunch of you who have pilot ideas that that we're hoping to work with you on as well.
Well, yes, to follow up on that question, one of the things that Jonathan Sallet emphasized so cogently today was the importance of using existing institutions to execute so that we can actually make the Recovery Act a recovery. One question that may come up as early as tomorrow morning, as we've discussed, Would you favor an expanded phase three in the existing SBIR program? A number of agencies, as you probably know, have phase 2Bs and phase 2B pluses, not to be confused with phase three, of course, but it's a there is this next phase, and it's not clear that we could set up a fund of funds early in our lifetimes. So what would you think?
Well, number one, we have to thank you, Chuck, for the work that you did analyzing the SBIR program, because for the first time going into this reauthorization, we've got a fact-based analysis, and I'm pretty data-driven, fact-based person, and now we can go and we can say, you know, this is exactly what the impact is. I won't repeat all the data for you because I've got an audience even more knowledgeable than I am, but this is very powerful and positive for us. And I think our priority is to get SBIR reauthorized. We would like to have some flexibility and some further things, but I think right now we are focused on taking a lot of your recommendations, in fact, and getting this reauthorization with some possibilities for some additional pilots. I think we can do a lot of things within SBIR if Congress is interested in doing them. But I think first they have to get on the bus, and we have to get this thing reauthorized. I think I'd just take two more if I can.
Yeah. Talk a little more about how you see this integration taking place across all these different agencies. We're trying to make in Washington State, a transition from oil, you know, so this is involving taxes, regulation, smart grid, electric cars, batteries, IT, et cetera. So in order to pull that off, a lot of different, you know, it's like a five-bank pool shot, you know. How do you create a hub that actually can accomplish a meaningful integration when we're talking about a state initiative? Is that hub going to be local or state level, or is that going to be at the federal level? How do you make it happen? I mean, it sounds very unrealistic to me at the moment.
So I think everybody in this room can answer this question. It's kind of all of the above, right? There is no one model, I think, is the conclusion I'm coming to, that is the only and the correct model. A couple of the things that you've heard about today that we're definitely going to pursue. The president cares a lot about integration between different agencies. He cares a lot about using the taxpayer money in a smart way. And he gives a lot of support to efforts where we work together. So we are working with Commerce. We are working with the U.S. Trade Representative to integrate the export activities. No point in having five different ones. And we are working very hard on health care, of course, across agencies. Just to begin, we're working with the Office of Science and Technology Policy. So I think the answer is all of the above. One of the most interesting questions is this connection between the state and regional stuff that has become, I think, so robust, and the federal programs. And I think that's going to have a variety of models. I happen to like clusters as one of those models, so you'll see me, you know, I'm sort of on record, I think, on why, and so are most of you, on why we think that works. There are times when that works. I want to say one thing about clusters. Don't forget that the best clusters, and the data from Europe actually does demonstrate this, are firm-led, they're industry-led. You've got to have those small businesses at the table. Do not forget them. And they will help you lead these viable clusters. So industry-led, firm-led, and of course, that's a place that, you know, that we very much are connected. So last, sorry.
Oh, thank you. Greg Horwitt, I wear two hats. One is I run a think tank at the University of California that works on cluster development, and I'm also a partner in a seed stage venture fund. But my question has to do with, we've been working on an idea to create a national entrepreneurs in residence program that's going to be partnering with the Kauffman Fellows program, where we're going to be creating somewhat of a Peace Corps for the venture industry to deploy some of these underutilized people who have been clustering in the Silicon Valley and Boston and redeploying them in some of these regions on a 1 to 2 year model, where they'd be working with these research institutes, and it would be both a venture fund as well as a educational point, so that they would work with the translation of the science from these institutes. What agencies here in Washington might be interested in supporting it? We're getting a lot of interest globally in this model, but in terms of the U.S.?
Well, I think the answer is once again, lots of them. Certainly energy, certainly this collaborative White House Institute that we're talking about. We are very much interested in partnering and are beginning to partner with a lot of you, but including Kauffman, Brookings, Mike Porter's shop. A number of folks are very much engaged in this. And I guess what I have to say is that if you listen to these initiatives that are out there, you get the feeling that we are going to be successful. We are not Amsterdam. This is not the end of our golden era. We are going to reinvent ourselves as a country because we have this spirit of entrepreneurship. We have the entrepreneurial know-how. We have entrepreneurial capital. We have the rule of law. And now we have the federal government, we hope, partnering with state and private institutions focused on this issue of turning innovation into jobs. I think this crisis has helped us also rethink. The past not coming back, we have to remake our foundations for our competitiveness. I believe, and I think most of you believe, that small business is going to be one of the core underpinnings, and that we have to find a way to take all this innovation that we have, to create these clusters of small companies, and to have them be part of the foundation stones of America's competitiveness and create those good-paying jobs. I would like to stay because this is kind of where my heart is, but I know that the afternoon is going to be pretty full and robust, so thank you very much.
Our MC is missing, so I'll just assume we're supposed to go right ahead. And I got a nod here from Jim Turner. I'm Bob Samors from the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. You may have known APLU in its previous life as Nostalgic. We just changed our name about a month ago. We've heard a lot of mentioned about the role of universities. Now we're going to hear from several folks talking about initiatives in different parts of the country. Luis will talk about Akron, the Akron experience. Dave McNamara will talk about South Carolina, and Ed Penhope about California. I wanted to take just a very quick minute and mention that APLU as an organization, as much as our member institutions have been engaged to one degree or another in economic growth and development activities over the years, APLU as an association recognized a couple of years ago that with all of the increasing expectations coming from external constituencies as well as the aspirations of many of our institutions and their leadership, that there was a need for perhaps some additional guidance, tools, resources that we might be able to provide the broad membership as they're moving forward in these areas. And for those of you who aren't familiar, APLU is about 215 members. We're the large public research universities as well as the 76 land-grant institutions and about 24 public university systems across the country. So we formed a Commission on Innovation, Competitiveness, and Economic Prosperity, which is chaired by Michael Crow, who we heard from this morning. And the focus has been to really try to provide some guidance and resources to our members to help them become basically the best possible partners in regional economic growth and development. With three primary areas of focus. One is trying to address the whole issue of coming up with some better metrics, measures of how institutions do contribute to their regional innovation ecologies, moving beyond the traditional measures of number of patents, licenses, royalty revenues, et cetera. In addition, trying to develop some tools that institutions can use to assess and evaluate and improve their participation in regional economic development, both looking at external relationships as well as internal processes, cultural issues, how do you motivate the faculty, et cetera. And then third, we, led by some folks, Tim Franklin and Nancy Franklin at Penn State, developed a proposal for the incoming administration on developing place-based regional innovation and talent hubs, or RITHs as we call them, that would take the capabilities of major research universities and place them in distressed areas, whether they be rural or urban, to try to help maximize the potential of the existing capabilities as well as grow new capabilities in concert with state, local, regional government and industry. So that's our agenda, but I want to turn it over to Luis first to talk about Akron. Okay.
Well, thank you, Bob, and good afternoon, everyone. Chuck asked that I share with you a little bit about how we have been evolving an approach that, for the sake of just a word, we've called the Akron model. And if you remember nothing else, it's really about relevance, about connectivity, and about productivity, or in short, making do with relatively little to come out with a significant outcome. As it happens, this I think you all will recognize is a nighttime image of the United States taken from a NASA satellite. And what this tells you is, of course, we're already very much clustered. And within these clusters, you find that 87% of all of the economic activity of the United States exists in our metropolitan areas, which are represented by the little bright dots of light. 80% of the colleges and universities and 83% of the students are there. And clearly, there's a lot of opportunities, certainly for all of us, because it represents such a large fraction of our GDP, but because it also provides opportunities for colleges and universities. This picture on the right is the region that I operate on, and it's that funny-looking thing on the right that looks, if you look at and use your imagination, a little bit like a bull. The horns are around the edges of Lake Erie, and the head comes down from Cleveland into Akron and into Canton. And the wonderful thing about it, as we've heard many times today, is that you can't see any political boundaries there, neither between the states that are at the edges here, nor certainly between the communities. So this is the ground that we play in. And as many of you know, often the sub-elements cross across many aspects of just these kinds of regions, and often across other sub-regions and regions that go into other states. This is what a map would look like, and just the bottom line is that we're in a pretty good area. We've got about 4 million people in the greater Akron area in a 50-mile radius there, and we're rapidly becoming a major marketing district. The clusters that are economically distributed within this region are these, and somebody mentioned Akron and rubber, and obviously rubber has continued in Akron, not in the form of tire manufacturing, but in the form of a highly diversified polymer industry that went from an original 4 companies to where today it's over 1,800 companies, a very strong biomedical industry, and I see Beju Shah in the background that runs BioEnterprise, and some of the others that hopefully will be strong and resurfacing, and some which are emerging. Challenges have been that this is, of course, an older industrial area. Many people called it the Rust Belt, and many other nice things that don't help. It has been risk-averse for a variety of reasons. There has been, for the most part, until more recently, a lack of investment capital, particularly on the part of the state. And for universities like mine, we've always lived in the shadow of those folks called Ohio State and Case Western, and as you'll see, never mind that they're not as productive as we. The opportunity comes from finding a way to assemble underutilized assets, obviously face the new economic realities, play in this area called the new urban environment, and evolve differentiated strategies with high productivity. Now, this is roughly the things that I want to talk about, and it's an evolving strategy. I'm going to hit on just a few of these elements with any degree of attention. But it's been evolving because it began, and I'll pretty much go from New Landscape to Learning to University Park to Research Foundation, UARF over there, to Bioinnovation and Innovation Alliance. But it began with a simple realization that we are nearing our 130th birthday a few years ago, where we were founded in 1870, the same decade as the major tire companies. And what that meant is that we evolved over this last 130 years right alongside with what was the rubber industry and the rubber capital of the world to what is today the polymer capital of the world. And we certainly have the largest polymer program in the world, as many of you know, and there's a great synergy between that program and many of the other sciences, and that'll be significant in a moment. And we are also among the top producers overall of chemistry PhDs with a truly remarkable high productivity in intellectual property and startup business, as you'll see in a moment, despite a very modest research portfolio. And we are, therefore, a research-intensive, focused research program institution. We've had some wonderful recognition. My colleague Diane Palmentera was here earlier from Innovation Associates, and she did a study supported by the National Science Foundation that identified that, indeed, among a number of small research portfolio institutions, the University of Akron was one of the most productive. The Board of Regents in Ohio agreed and indeed gave us money ahead of Ohio State and Case Western because of our high degree of productivity, University Economic Development Association, the Milken Institutes, and others. And in the most recent autumn survey, we ranked seventh among those institutions that do not have a medical school in absolute dollars of licensing revenues, and normalized on a per dollar of research input, we were number one in the country. Now, what we found is that we needed to transform both the university and the region, and so we began by transforming the university, a $500 million initiative that resulted in, frankly, a rebuilding of the campus with 15 new buildings, 17 major additions and renovations, 36 acres of new space, 30,000 new trees, bushes, et cetera, closing of two streets, new walkways, plazas and terraces, gardens, in short, making a brand new campus, and this fall we'll inaugurate a brand new football stadium, which will act as an anchor structure to revitalize some other aspects of the community. And from that, we did some nice buildings along the way, and it obviously anything we do adds economic value to the community, as you might imagine, immediately, because that's $500 million of investment that Team NEO never reports, by the way, Beiju. Okay. And so we found that the one thing that was critical is 7,000 of our students were not living on campus. They were living in the immediate neighborhoods, and if you went there, you'd realize you wouldn't want your son or daughter to live there. So we started something called the University Park Alliance. The middle blue area is the university. The light blue is downtown. And everything inside that black boundary is what we call University Park. It's over 1,000 acres, et cetera. And our goal is to try to make this a nice place to live, work, and play. We want to transform it, and we started to be joined by the city as well as by the other major resident in the area, Summa Health System, represented there by the CEO, Tom Strauss. We added some partners here, and in particular, the most critical one was the Knight Foundation, which came in and agreed that this was a good idea, provided us some seed money, which is now into about $13 million. That's walking around money to begin to catalyze this kind of transformation that you see here. And the progress report is that we're fairly close in a number of areas with nearly the goal number in jobs, and not as many houses as we'd hope, but a significant number of leveraged investment, $52 million in civic investments, not including our own $500 million, $300 million in confirmed other private sector investments, and multiple recognition awards in that. Okay? So we've begun that transformation that's very much about what we feel is necessary for the health of the institution. Like many universities, we have a research foundation. In our case, it started in 2001 to build on a very, very significant historic record of productivity in the university. And that's why foundations exist. I won't bother you with that. But unlike most traditional foundations or technology transfer things, which is what research foundations tend to do, that do licensing in university startups, ours is a little bit more complex and comprehensive, okay? So at the risk of confusing you there, the bottom line here that I'd like, and I'll call out a few things here, is that the portfolio of a university's impact through its own technology and its own know-how and its own outreach, is far broader than we have traditionally recognized. Okay? And we began by looking at the assets that were in the environment and recognizing that many companies were downsizing in a lot of areas. They couldn't operate their technical libraries, so they donated them to the university. We managed them. They continue to be able to use them, but at a much lower cost. Similarly, for space, for an instrumentation, as well as for people and their own patents. We also then began to work very much actively on industry research. And remember that presently, industry-sponsored research at universities accounts for less than 5% of all university-based research. Huge opportunity. Moving along through the usual things into university-related commercialization of other people's patents, but related to ours, into industry-centric initiatives in partnership that has resulted in a number of for-profits, and entrepreneurship that I'll come back to in just a moment, as well as the development of a foundation that is now offering our services to other institutions. But in order to get away from partnering paranoia, which I'll come back to, we're calling it not the Akron Research Foundation, but the Ohio Research Foundation. Be happy to take questions on this later. This is the patent activity in the last few years. This is the division of the portfolio, which I've it's diversified, but heavily concentrated in materials and in medical or biomedical. And this is the growth of startup companies, up to about 28 companies in the last 5 years. By the way, Michigan brags that it started 26 companies in the last 5 years. They have $850 million. We have less than 50, so there you are. We also bought two buildings to create an innovation campus, and it is serving us very nicely. Obviously, we're having a mixture of tenants, some startup companies, but also some just traditional companies. And we have a series of what we call Research Foundation Fellows. These are volunteers. These are people who are either retired or just between jobs. They work for nothing. We pay them nothing. The Research Foundation, by the way, has only one employee, but by the way, obviously a lot of help from all of us, okay? But these folks have the know-how. They stimulate the work around them. And how do they get paid off? They start companies, and they take an equity position in them as we go forward. But you see, we have five presently. We have some student interns. And this is a way to save your region $4 to $5 million that you would otherwise need to invest in creating an intermediary. They have started an angel network that supplements the other broad and more established intermediaries. And certainly, there was a person from Jumpstart here earlier, and Beju from BioEnterprise. We've had 45 companies present, and they report, just informally, $36 million in follow-up investments. At the request of Procter & Gamble, we are also offering open innovation seminars and bringing open innovation to work in Northeast Ohio. And obviously, you've seen this diagram before, and that's kind of how things begin to work in that sense of relevant connectivity with high productivity. Now, let me give you just one example of the things that never occur to you until somebody makes it obvious. Polymers has been our major strength. Many of you may know that if you take the calcium and the water in out of your body, the rest of you is basically polymeric stuff. Okay, so biomaterials becomes an exceptionally great opportunity as we move forward into it, the interdisciplinary relationship between material science and biomedical applications. So we went and asked the three major hospitals in Akron, which are significant entities, as well as a regional public medical school, if they would come together with us and join to form a new entity. They agreed. It was catalyzed by another grant from the Knight Foundation, matched by the state and private and private as well as the partner investments, and is supporting the city's of Akron's biomedical corridor. And in short, it is an initiative that is now dedicated to making Akron the number one biomaterials and orthopedic research program in the world, and implementing particularly a center for biomaterials and medicine. Innovation Alliance, all I will mention here is this is a partnership with a community college that's very productive in our region. There are three major initiatives, but one that is literally marrying our information technology support service into a shared services platform, and we'll be offering that as services to others, the other things you can look at later. What are the lessons learned? Shortly, we In short, we have assembled weak assets to create new strengths. We've assembled the guerrilla entrepreneurial talent at no cost. We've found uncommon but synergistic partners. You know, how many years ago would it be that a university without a medical school would think of partnering with three hospitals? It just wasn't thought about. Certainly not if you were strong in material science. We recognize that the city and the community are very integral partners, and we have a markedly expanded concept of what the university's product line and tool chest is, as you saw in that broad research foundation chart that everybody kind of went, oops, okay. We manage these assets very closely with other regional assets to pursue unique opportunities. It's all about relevance and connectivity. You have to be prepared, however, for conflict of egos, for partnership paranoia, for relationship fatigue, and for losing control to gain leverage. This is simply illustrating that the way that universities engage with their community has been evolving since at least 1862. The new era is of alliances in a knowledge-based open innovation economy. It's still evolving. It's towards a much expanded sense of relevance and connectivity for every university discipline, not just science and technology, although clearly those are driving the economic clusters that we're talking about. So the university is becoming key in this conceptual economy as a convener, as a developer, and as anchors for these kinds of capital, creative knowledge, human, social, financial, and natural. I borrowed these five elements of a new university strategy, and I'll end very quickly with these. I borrowed these in part from a report from the Department of Commerce called Strengthening Communities and adapted it to reflect the lessons learned. So it's a public purpose tied to enhancing the health of our regional economies. It has to be fully integrated into common strategies at the national, state, and regional levels. Obviously, much of what we've learned today is that linking even to the state is difficult, and to the federal region, federal level is very difficult. Look at the satellite map. Don't look at the political boundary map. It doesn't work that way. All regions should have a competitive strategy that identifies a niche, that develops a strategy for regional competitiveness, that addresses critical needs for implementing it, and explores sustainable growth. And finally, it's not just as a province of government to strengthen communities. Relevance and connectivity is what it's about. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave McNamara with the South Carolina Research Authority, and I've always wanted to say this. I'm going to say I want to thank the Academy, and I go back and tell my wife I got to come up and say that. So. But thank you for having me here. I'm neither a scientist nor a researcher, but I do support a lot of that activity in South Carolina. SCRA is a parent company, South Carolina Research Authority. It basically does not take, it does not seek, nor will it accept state appropriations. It earns its funding from competitive federal contracts with mission-oriented agencies. So it's about $180 million going to several hundred million. We just won the largest contract in our history, $700 million ordnance contract. So everything bigger than a 50 caliber bullet and less than a nuclear warhead, we're working on that type thing. So that's what the company, parent company, does. In 2005, do I need to stay near the microphone or do I talk loud enough? Okay. In 2005, the legislature said, we put you in business 25 years ago with a little bit of land we gave you, and you've done a good job, but you've done nothing for the state of South Carolina. So they said, you will focus on the state of South Carolina, and you will focus on the three research universities, the larger ones, for us, Medical University of South Carolina, University of South Carolina, and Clemson. And you will focus on the research coming out of those entities. And I'll show you a slide in a minute that ties it together, and commercialize this research. So that's when I got hired to start what's called the South Carolina Public Interest Sector. And our job is to work with the universities commercializing their research. This is going to look a lot like Mary Ann's sausage machine. It even looks like one that turns, right? But the legislature developed the Endowed Chairs Act in 02, so they're funding chairs in the universities to bring in some world-class talent. And understand, we're a small state, a relatively rural state, and we're late getting started in this. but we're moving up quickly, I think, and I'll talk about some stats in a minute. They put the Research Infrastructure Act into place, which funds buildings, equipment to help attract this world-class talent. It's something that most states already have, for example, what we call light rail or lambda rail, right, to Internet. We did not have that connecting the universities. We just completed that in the last year. This is where we came in. They said, okay, we're putting this into effect. How are we going to commercialize this research? They passed these two acts saying, SCRA, go out and commercialize this research. Build innovation centers. Look at economic centers of excellence of your own centered around, again, the research universities. So my bosses really are Clemson University, MUSC, SCRA, University of South Carolina. We're supposed to be creating startups. We're supposed to help the applied research and commercialization. We're supposed to bring this into the universities, partnerships between industry and university. Michael Porter seems to have been everywhere, but he was in South Carolina and helped us come up with a five-year plan that related to clusters and research. I'm supposed to focus SC Launch, which is our entity to do this, on new advances in knowledge-based industries, establish forum to foster dialogue, and assist the university research foundations. Now, I am not really, or we are not, my team and I, specifically focused on clusters. There's another entity called New Carolina Council on Competitiveness. George Fletcher runs it. Does a great job of building clusters of existing industries. But in a minute, I'll show how we're starting to form clusters of emerging industries in South Carolina. These are the sectors we were told in the Innovation, the Mandated Act to focus on: advanced materials and fibers, alternative energy, automotive, engineering and chemicals, life sciences, biotech, related information technology and software. We'll skip this. Basically, we come in, we can provide, we're economic development, but we also have some seed funding capability. I've seen several cuts at this pipeline, but going from left to right, it's going from an idea to an innovation. And really, it takes a lot of work, a lot of people, and a lot of cash to get there. But we provide services along the way, incentives over here to investments on the right-hand side as they move forward within the university through the various stages to get to VC funding. I tend to talk fast because people listen three times as fast as somebody talks anyway, so I'll probably finish early and get this moving. I did have to, but boss wanted me to make sure that I let you know that people in South Carolina do wear shoes. And, these were tie shoes. It was tough finding somebody this morning to do that. some of the acceptance guidelines to be in our program, and this is an important difference. You can be in our program. There are several 130 companies that we've helped start in the last 3 years. We're only 3 years old last month. We're talking about $850 in Michigan and $50 million and $50 million in Ohio. I've got $6 million to work with. So I have to do a lot of leveraging. And I raise that money from individual taxpayers in the state, donate the money to me, and they're able to get tax credits to offset taxes. So we have to do it by working with every other entity in the state. The good news about being a small state is I can get all the decision makers in a room when a company wants to come to town. An example, we just landed Zeiss Optics there. Right, we're working with, another one I can't name right now, but a large MRAP manufacturer for mine-resistant vehicles. And we're able to get the state, the county, regional, all the economic development people in one room at one time, legislators and whoever's necessary. We're looking for high impact potential. They have to have intellectual property that's protected or protectable. If they're linked to a South Carolina research university, it's beneficial to them. It's a plus. It's not a necessity. Our resource network, again, we've got accountants, lawyers, marketing folks. We've negotiated rates. In some cases, we don't recommend, but we present, you know, these folks to our companies and vice versa. We hold about once a month in each of our towns. We hold get-to-know-each-other events, and the partners come, get to meet the, you know, the client companies. And we're told out of the 30 companies we've actually invested in out of the 130, that the money was important, but not near as important as the coaching and the mentoring and cocooning and the buffering and the good housekeeping seal and all those things you hear about. And we heard this from Rich and Matt at Innovation Works when we were first getting started and went up to see what we could steal from them. And they told us that this was the case, and we're seeing it to be true. Getting to the end now, some of the results to date, again, we're young, but we've got about $65 million in follow-on funding been secured by our companies. The average salary of our company in our company is $77,000, and this is in a state where the per capita income runs somewhere between 38 and 50, depending on the area and who you talk to. We've got 130 members of our Circle of Innovation, which are the resource partners that want to participate and the people that contribute to us. We've got 106 companies that receive some form of funding. 118 are receiving support at this point. 36 innovation prizes. This is just a number of things that we've done. We were fortunate. I saw Dan here earlier, but we won an award from SSTI that we were very proud to go out and receive this past year. Here's the company. Now, I talked earlier, we were not told to go out and form clusters. Someone else is doing that, but we work very closely. But they're forming on their own. If you look at engineering and chemicals, you know, 26 of our companies are engineering and chemicals. Life sciences, biotech, and biomed is a large chunk of them. So we bring these folks together quite often in a speed dating type mode and host events where they can exchange information. We bring in national speakers. We've pretty much picked up the banner for the bio effort in the state and as far as the trade shows and working in that regard. Very interesting, sitting in the room back here is Chris Presemble from Clemson University. And I have to be, he's one of my bosses, so I hate it when one of my bosses is in the room listening to me. But automotive is a small but growing sector of our program, but it's a huge program in a cluster in the state. CUICAR, International Center for Automotive Research. It has, we talked about being led by industry, right? So it's got Clemson there, it's got state government, but it's got BMW, Timken, Toyota, you name it, just Chris, tons of them, a very successful automotive and sports, motorsports cluster in the state and growing. So the supplier companies are coming in to support the BMWs, and that's growing. Another is the life sciences and biotech tend to be clustering around Medical University of South Carolina. And if we look at the University of South Carolina, we have a very successful hydrogen program. Now, we're under attack because hydrogen, Secretary Chu is repealed, taking some of the money back out of it. Our governor thinks it's a waste of time to put money into that right now. The legislature thinks it's we need to do it. So we're not doing it to save the world or to save the environment. We're doing it to create jobs. Not that. So when we catch the flack to say that's too far off, I can point to two or three companies that we have had locate in the state that are producing portable power and standby power hydrogen fuel cell type activity. So I would say alternative energy, automotive, and bio are forming up as clusters in the state as a result of activities directly related to the universities. That's just some comments from the client companies. Again, we're funded entirely not from any funding from the state, but money we go out and raise. And this is our website if you wanted to know more, sclaunch.org. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. As it says, I'm Ed Penhode. I'm actually giving this talk for Susan Hackwood. Susan is the chairman of the California Commission on Science and Technology. She was scheduled to give this talk but couldn't come today, so I'm filling in for Susan. But I'm a lifelong Californian, so I'm probably reasonably able to give this talk, and I've been quite involved in a number of the initiatives that we'll talk about here today. California, as you've undoubtedly all read, is verging on bankruptcy, so I'm not sure how much of this will be relevant in the future, but certainly I'm going to tell you about what California has done with its money as a state in the past. Been an interesting day for me, actually, to listen to all of the organized efforts to create clusters and to enhance local economic activity, because in California we have none of these. All of our activities have sort of been homegrown. Largely, as I said earlier today, derived from the very powerful universities within the state and a number of clear advantages the state has had in the past, but we have actually never had an explicit program in California to do any of the kinds of things that we just heard about in South Carolina. Probably to some degree jeopardizes our future, but nevertheless, that is the reality of where we are. In spite of that, the state of California has had a number of programs itself that sort of top down and general throughout the state to stimulate the investment in science and technology enterprises. So, as it says on this slide, historically we've inherited some assets which have been useful: the geography, the climate, the natural resources, and the population of California. About 10% of the country lives in California now, to created assets. And again, top universities have been a major driver of the technology industries within California. California is the leading state in biotechnology. It's also the leading state in information technology. Much of the IT world grew out of Stanford initially, and Berkeley played a very important role in that, localized in the Bay Area. And biotech industry has essentially grown up around the major centers in San Francisco and in San Diego. Maybe one interesting aside there, though: a robust company doesn't always create a cluster of companies. If you look at the biotech industry, California's biotech industry is segregated largely in two places, San Francisco and in San Diego. California's largest independent biotech company is Amgen. It happens to be located in Thousand Oaks, California. It has never spawned the number of progeny that, for example, Genentech and some of the companies in San Diego. It's an interesting lesson. It's a little bit isolated geographically, has not associated itself with any university historically, there is no robust biotech industry in Los Angeles around California's largest independent biotech company. We do have a number of research centers, as I've just said. Talented people, quite frankly, exist everywhere, but California has had at least its share of those. There is an entrepreneurial spirit in California, and I think as I was listening to the talks today and the notion that you need people to have courage to start new businesses, and you need people in an environment which supports that. So, you know, I do think the renewed, if you will, glass half full for America that we're currently undergoing, the people's attitude, mental attitude about entrepreneurism, about starting new things, is an important, very important issue. I once asked a friend of mine, why do you think Stanford has been so incredibly prolific in starting new companies? The total number of companies were started by Stanford people. And his answer was, well, as a group, they're cocky. And I don't think he meant cocky in the usual sense of that word, but they simply don't believe they can't go out and do things. So it's really a mentality as much as anything else that I think we have to strive for going forward. We do have lots of networks. They're informal for the most part. And then we have had some major downturns, and I think we've heard that those always bring some opportunities. Here are some suggested government guidelines from Susan. Put the pieces together, make the right bets. Again, you have to choose winners. Over the years, my own background is partly in the university world, partly in the business world. I can't tell you how many visits from people from foreign countries come to ask me, well, gee, how can we create a biotech industry in Germany or France or whatever it is? What's the secret of success here? And almost always, their failure to understand what's required in the fertile ground to plant a seed. So, you know, Germany would be a good example. They've tried to bring up the high-tech sectors in eastern Germany by putting a biotech center in Dresden, for example, and other places. Simply doesn't work. You can't just say, we're going to build some facilities here and bring some people here and make it work, because this area needs economic development. You have to have a robust plan and some reason for believing it will thrive where you put it. So I do think that you have to pick winners when you do your things. And we've heard a lot today about people choosing things that draw on existing expertise, so you have the wherewithal to be a winner. Innovate for the real world. Clearly, we've also heard a lot about that. We are in a global economy. I think we've witnessed a largely a disconnect between ownership and economic activity now. We talk about General Motors and Chrysler being American companies. Frankly, nobody knows who owns those companies today. 25% of the New York Stock Exchange is owned by foreign entities of one sort or another, and vice versa around the world. So, you know, the conversations we're having here are really about where you actually locate economic activity. And the location is what we've been talking about today. Invest in collaboration. I'll touch on that in a moment. Listen to smart people. There are plenty of smart people around, but try to engage smart people in the discussions. Too many of the groups have been isolated historically. And then patience is always a virtue, I suppose. Why is state government important? Clearly, state governments are major investors in human capital, all the way from elementary schools to doctoral degrees. We're very proud of, in California, what we do with doctoral degrees, but not very proud of what we do with K-8 education. We have quite an interesting challenge in California going forward, which is that the state is becoming significantly dominated by Hispanic culture. Two-thirds of the babies born in California last year were born to Hispanic mothers. So the state is rapidly transforming into a very different demographic than we've had historically. There are many wonderful things about the Hispanic culture, but embracing science and technology is not a historical strength of that culture. And an understanding of that, I think, for all Californians is an important element in going forward. Infrastructure is obvious. Regulatory control is a sometimes overlooked issue. When I was the CEO of a biotech company in California, we wanted to build a new facility in the Bay Area. We needed permission from 18 different regulatory agencies just in California to build a new building. And there's a significant biotech manufacturing enterprise in California now in a small town called Vacaville, which is near the state capitol. Why is it there? Primarily because the government of Vacaville decided that they would be one-stop shopping for the 18 agencies and pulled together all these things. So people worry about all these macro issues, and oftentimes it's whether you can get a permit from the local sewage agency to deal with the effluent that you're creating a factory, which is important. So this one-stop shopping notion, whether it's at the federal level, the state level, or community level, turns out to be very important. And then California has funded a number of research entities itself. So there have been the state UC Discovery Grants. This is a program I'll show you some data on in a minute, where the state has invested money in UC to be used only if UC finds partners in the private sector to jointly apply for money and to use that money in a joint program. And the projects have to have an outcome associated with the funding. So they're supposed to work on a project together to do something relevant to society and hopefully end up in creating a business. In the year 2000, when California had some money, the state set up four California Institutes for Science and Innovation within the UC system. These four are two in the IT world, one at UC San Diego and UC Irvine together, a nanotechnology initiative at UCLA and UC Santa Barbara, a second IT infrastructure program at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and UC Davis, and then a biomedical one at UC San Francisco, UC Berkeley, and UC Santa Cruz. So they're multi-campus in their origin and in their conduct. They have a theme associated with each and every one of those. They've raised collectively almost $1 billion to support the work that's been going on in those things and have been a major driver of growth in those three different areas, IT, biomedical science, and in nanotechnology within the state. In 2004, the voters approved a $3 billion stem cell research initiative. This is at a time when the federal government was not supporting stem cell research. We've heard within this, it's been a wonderful boon to research in California on stem cells. But I think we have to remind ourselves that the voters of California voted for this initiative not because they wanted to support research, but because they expect outcomes, health outcomes from this stem cell initiative. So You know, there was 60% of the voters in California voted to spend $3 billion on stem cell research. Part of it was a, however term you want to describe you, George Bush, and the other part of the vote was because people believed that they were going to get tangible healthcare results if they put this investment into stem cell research in California. And it was driven in part, unfortunately, by the deaths of two prominent Californians, Ronald Reagan from Alzheimer's disease, and many of you may remember Nancy Reagan was a strong proponent of this research because it could potentially help people who suffer from Alzheimer's. I'm having a senior moment, the movie star who died of his spinal cord injuries.
Christopher Reeve.
Thank you, Christopher Reeve. They both died right in front of this election, and Christopher Reeve's then surviving spouse also was a strong proponent of stem cell research. So there were a number of factors that led the California voters themselves to actually vote to spend $3 billion on stem cell research. And then in 2009, possible, I'd say at the present time, unlikely, however, there is a new climate change institute proposed. Now, I might add, not on this slide, University of California, together with the University of Illinois, were the winners of a competition started by British Petroleum to fund $500 million of R&D in the clean energy world. So Steve Coonan was the vice president of BP at the time, now the deputy director of the Department of Energy. And so UC and Illinois were very involved in that, but the state had to come up with some matching money. So that also was another state contribution to actually allow them to compete effectively for the $500 million in funding from a private source. So just some data on what these things have done over time. This is the Discovery Grant Program. As you can see, the UC piece has been about $15 million, and industry has contributed about $20 million to the program overall. And it's in a whole variety of different areas, as you see here, some of them new to the program at the bottom, not yet funded. But nevertheless, it's been a widely used program, not totally different in some ways than SBIR. There's fairly small grants, but they actually are seed grants to get people started working on projects. The Institutes for Science and Innovation, I've mentioned before, have been set up throughout the state. And so the total investment in these, well, it's been $400 million by the state. Each of the institutes got $100 million. Primarily for facilities and for startup monies, but those have generated an additional $800 million in support from the federal government and the private sector. So the total investment in these, stimulated by the state investment, has been somewhat over $1 billion. And then Proposition 71, as I said, authorized $3 billion in principal and $3 billion in interest to fund stem cell research in California. It's an interesting issue. Good for us and bad for the state. Good for us. I've been the vice chair of the Stem Cell Commission since its inception. Good for us in the sense this program is insulated from the activities of the legislature, who can't cut our budget because Prop 71 is embedded in the Constitution of the state of California. This is one of California's problems as they try to deal with budgetary issues. There are too many things embedded in the Constitution of the state, which are not under the control of the legislature. So when we have difficult financial times, as we do in California now, the state legislature has very limited capacity to actually deal with a financial crisis because most of the spending is not under their control. This spending is not under their control, so it will go on during this period of time. I would mention, however, that the initiative itself had two explicit goals. One was to find cures for disease using stem cells as a therapy or stem cells as a tool. The second was to enhance California's competitive position or to ensure its long-term position as the world's leading geography for the biotech industry. So it had an industry-specific goal embedded within the initiative itself. So it wasn't just for health, it was also the economic benefits which accrue would accrue from this. We have so far at the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, we have committed about $1 billion in grant money in the last 4 years to the initiative. We have established, I think, the most robust stem cell program in the world as a result, because in many other places, stem cell funding was quite lacking. And in addition to that, we've attracted numerous scientists from outside the United States to come to California and to participate in the stem cell work that goes on within the state. So it has had a very positive effect. We believe we're the leaders in stem cell work now. There is a question in the case now that federal funds will be available for this field, what the unique role of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine will be compared to the federal one. And this probably won't happen soon, so I'll skip it. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much. Maybe if I can make one closing comment, though. We've heard a lot about collaboration today, and I want to put out a warning about collaboration. And I'll just give you an anecdote. For some years, I was president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. We support science in universities, and we had a program to support universities generally. We had a parade of university presidents come through and tell us about how their faculty were all working together across disciplines, from engineering to medicine to chemistry, all, you know, holding hands, singing Kumbaya, and together they were going to solve all the problems of the world. If it didn't take more than 5 minutes to find out it was all talk from university presidents with no real substance underneath. And so we had a joke at the Moore Foundation that said, next time a university president calls, we're going to say, why don't you stay home? You can save the money for the trip. We'll play the tape of the last university president that was here, and we're going to hear exactly the same story. And my experience has been collaboration only works if people have something meaningful to do together. You can't just cram people together and say, now collaborate, because it's a good thing to collaborate. Unless you have a project, something they can really work on, they'll come to a few meetings and eventually dissipate. So collaboration is great if it works. But I would have a strong position that it doesn't make sense to try to force collaboration, which doesn't have a fundamental basis from the bottom up. Okay, with that, I will close. Thank you.
Chuck, do we have time for a question or two? Okay, I'm going to take the prerogative, but if anybody does want to ask a question, please stand on the microphone. Sort of picking up on Ed's comment, I'm curious from Dave and Luis's perspective, what are the key elements of that need to be present within the universities in order to create productive partnerships?
Fundamentally, the incentives to do so, wherewithal get people interested in doing just that.
I would say, first of all, language is different. I notice when I talk to the university folks, they say they've commercialized something, they mean they've licensed it out. And that's typically when its process is starting. So we get together a lot, try to educate each other. We thought we knew it all, and we learned a lot from them. The other would be getting inside. The investigators and the researchers don't want to go through the hassle typically of filing discovery, because then they're pulled away from their research, and the last thing some of them want to do is commercialize research. They want to keep doing it. So you've got to win their trust and get inside there and walk the floor and encourage them to file that discovery.
Thank you. Questions? All right, well, please join me. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment to Ed's point about collaboration. I work in the technology licensing office, and many, many of the disclosures that we get are cross-disciplines. So the collaborations are occurring at the universities, but to your point also, they're occurring because they're all focused around a particular goal or problem to solve.
We hired two global research leaders in the field of biofuels and in the area of nanophotonics. And we're hoping that they will attract federal funds, partnerships, and help create an emerging new industry cluster, right? I'm interested in all of your answers. If you think this type of program does pay off, and what are some things to look out for in order to maximize the potential for success. We're putting some more money into this this coming year, and I hope we're on a good path here, but I think we need some guidance to make sure we don't make some mistakes here.
Well, Elgus, certainly that strategy that a lot of states have followed, the programs that are called Eminent Scholars Programs, by and large, I think have been successful. I think the lessons are fundamentally good, that the person you're attracting has the stamina, has the interest, need already perhaps an emerging entrepreneur track record, and that the prospects of their continued funding are there. So that's my suggestion.
Well, maybe if I could, very hard to find, but if you can find people who both some good taste in science and some reasonable business skills, extremely valuable. But, you know, my own experience, the recipe for disaster is to hire a bunch of good company who don't understand the science, and a bunch of good scientists who don't want to understand it. And in general, they both lie long, and then you driving off a cliff together. But yeah, so, you know, it is hard to find entrepreneurs who have a science background or enough science or dialogue. I mean, it's the same issue, communication. Do you the meaning?
South Carolina, after we talk about the Valley of Death, but, you know, the second biggest problem we have is a short people on the beach. We're game. And so South Carolina, again, it tends to be a little late to the game getting started, so we don't have a lot of serial entrepreneurs on the beach ready to do it again. We're starting to build that now. So to entice them in is also difficult because they say, geez, if this one fails, you know, there's not a lot of other opportunities. So we're looking at guaranteeing a certain several years of salary or income to entice some of these people to come in.
One more question.
Actually, it's just a comment about the business and the science. I was privileged to be part of a seminar at MIT for 2 days, and we had presentations from faculty dealing with nuclear. It was on sustainable energy, the science and technology side, but the last part of it, we had presentations from people from Sloan School of Management, and there were lots of interesting ways in which they sustain the collaboration. So that could take place within the university where you'd have both, developing both those kinds of skills. Just a comment.
I'd like to thank Chuck for the opportunity to participate myself, and the association stands ready to continue working with you and others on these issues. And please thank the rest of our panel for their participation.